Lee urgently. I didn't imagine in a million years that Sari would have an episode when she was alone with you, she said apologetically. I meant to tell you about her this weekend. Raoul has a version of some super cyber game he wants us all to test, and I was supposed to ask you to come as well. That's what he does for work, tests and creates games. Oh, and sometimes he builds websites. She stopped, as if to collect her thoughts, but grief seemed to rush in on her again, because she said, Oh God, poor Sari, if only one of us had been there with you. We might have managed to calm her without her having to go to hospital. Harrison said you all believe she's infected with some sort of sickness. I suppose you think we're all mad, Jilly guessed. When Harrison said we should try believing her, I was afraid we might be doing her harm by encouraging a dangerous delusion. But he said, what if she really does see something we can't see? Raoul was all for it. He says people see him as sick because he's in a wheelchair, even though he's perfectly healthy, aside from not being able to use his legs. He said getting treated as if you're sick makes you feel sick, and maybe the only thing wrong with Sari was that people didn't believe her. The funny thing is that even though it was Harrison's idea, it's Raoul that Sari goes to when the wrongness is getting stronger. She stays with him. Well, that wouldn't be allowed, but she spends a lot of her days there, and Raoul drives her home at night. He drives, I said, and wished I hadn't. Jilly just laughed. He has a specially made car. It cost a fortune, but he makes a lot of money from his work. It used to amaze me that he would want to drive. That's how he got so hurt. A car accident. I blinked at the receiver, trying to imagine how much courage it must take for Raoul to get into a car when it had so savaged him. Then I wondered how I could think of a car in the face of what we had been talking about. As if she felt the same, Jilly's voice went serious. We're going to see Sari tonight. A small pause. Do you want to come? No, I said. Harrison had been right to steer me away from seeing her so soon after what had happened, but I wanted very much to talk to her when it was possible. After I had put the phone down, I thought about Jilly and the others, believing Sari, choosing to believe that she was the carrier of a contagious spiritual sickness which could not be detected by medical science. What would they say if I told them that, like Sari, I could perceive things other people could not, including the very sickness that Sari carried? Except I hadn't smelled anything on Sari, which either meant that her sickness was not what I had smelled on Dr. Austin or Harlan, or that Sari was not infected. My reflections were too confused and contradictory, and I knew that the best way to sort out the muddle was just to leave it for a bit. So I managed, by a supreme effort of will, to immerse myself in homework for almost an hour. But finally, thoughts of Harlan and Dr. Austin and Sari began creeping back in. I gave up trying to concentrate and threw myself into housework. I changed the sheets on my bed, sorted out a pile of dirty laundry and carried it downstairs, returning with an armful of dry washing that Da had brought in off the line. I folded it and put it away, then swept the bedroom, even Serenity's side. Not that there was anything to sweep up. It wasn't so much that she was obsessively clean as that she just didn't do anything to make a mess. When she came home from school these days, she would lie on the bed, fully clothed except for her shoes, which she always set neatly together on the floor at the foot of the bed. Then she would fold her hands together on her stomach and close her eyes, like she was laid out for burial. On impulse, I went to her bed and lay on it, even closing my eyes and composing my hands as she did. I didn't feel anything other than pretty comfortable. I don't know what I thought it would tell me. Finally, I decided to take a walk. I pulled on a jumper, a light coat, and runners before slipping out the front door. I had no particular destination in mind, but when I came to a reserve where Jesse, Miranda, and I used to ride our bikes when we were younger, I went into it, feeling nostalgic about younger, less troubled times. The part of the reserve that met the street frontage was narrow and kind of bare. Kids could play ball or throw frisbees, but further back there were trees, and then more trees, until the reserve turned into a wilderness crisscrossed by tracks, some designated for walkers and others for push bikes. The more rugged and rutted were used by mountain bike riders. I took what I remembered was the longest trail, which looped through the whole reserve, before coming back to the beginning, a good solid hour's walk. As I set off, I remembered a game we used to play there. Like all our games, it had grown out of hide-and-seek and involved pretending the wilderness was a maze-like subterranean network of caves through which we were being pursued by imaginary bears. For me, these were the underbears that had come creeping out of the cracks in the earth. We could only escape their fangs and claws by freezing and being utterly still. Whenever Jesse, who was always in charge of them, said they were near, I remembered how exquisite the terror had been when occasionally Jesse had decided to become one of the bears and had come lumbering and snarling towards us. We had frozen and tried not to move or react to anything he did as he snuffled and butted and sometimes even licked us. I smiled, remembering that, right alongside knowing it was Jesse and wanting to giggle at his antics. I had been genuinely aghast that a bear would rend and eat me. It's funny how you can do that as a kid, totally believe in something and know at the same time that it isn't real. But maybe it's because a kid's life is full of unknown things and imagined things and real things all blurred together. The sky had been darkening imperceptibly, and all at once it started to rain. I ran, but after a minute I slowed down again because it wasn't that cold and I was soaked to the bone anyway. I was walking maybe 10 more minutes when I heard muffled shouts above the hissing of the rain. I extended my hearing and heard the whirring of wheels. I stopped, puzzled as to where they could be coming from. They were so close that I ought to have been able to see the speakers coming along the track from one direction or another. The rain stopped just as suddenly as it had started, and a breeze began to blow. I heard the snap of a twig, just in time to leap sideways from the path, before a boy on a mountain bike exploded from the bushes beside me. He turned his wheel so swiftly to angle himself along the track that he had to have known it was there. Catching sight of me, he gave a yelp of startled fright, and his bike wobbled wildly, but he managed to get control of it before he sped out of sight. A moment later, two other boys burst through the same bushes on their bikes, but they didn't notice me. I heard them yelling to one another, and their voices faded until I could hear nothing but rising wind rustling the leaves and the slowing hammer of my heart. 10 minutes later, I came to an open area that had been turned into a sort of lunar landscape of various sized humps that trail bike riders obviously used. The boys that had nearly run me down must have broken through from here. There was no sign of them now, of course. By the time I got home, my teeth were chattering hard and I was sneezing. But I felt good, because somewhere on the walk, without ever really thinking about it, I realized that I had made up my mind to tell Jilly and Harrison and Raoul the truth about myself. 23. Miranda was busy cooking veggie pasties for dinner, so after I had a hot shower and changed, I helped her with the tedious job of grating vegetables as we listened to an interview she'd taped for school. It was a man talking about the Ebola epidemic in Africa and how many people were infected. The figures were shocking, and I found myself imagining a country where half the population was sick and dying. If it was America or Australia or England, it would have been on the news every night, and the whole Western world would be mobilized to try to help. But because it was Africa, you hardly saw or read anything about it. The man called it a secret epidemic, though it was less secret, he said bleakly, than something from which the Western world had simply turned their eyes. When the tape clicked off, we grated in silence for a bit, and some impulse made me say, "Sometimes people do horrible things for no reason at all." A while back, a journalist told my class about a guy not much older than us who killed his younger brother. He didn't hate him or anything. He just decided to do it, planned it, and did it. Miranda stared at me. He must have had some reason, or maybe he was crazy. Well, that's what the court decided, I said. But I found myself wondering if the guy who had done the murdering had been infected with wrongness, and that this was what had led him to kill his brother. Because if Dr. Austin and Harlan Sanderson were infected by spiritual sickness that could not be detected by conventional science, why not others as well? Then I started thinking about Sari and her belief that she was infected. and what Harrison had said about her childhood. I couldn't help but wonder if the woman in the vision had been her mother, and if so, how what I had seen had affected her. After dinner, I dialed Jilly's number, wanting to know how Sari was, but there was no answer. When I finally got to bed, I didn't dream about Sari or Harlan, but about Aya, being held prisoner inside the detention center. I clambered up the wall, which had grown 3 times higher, but had also developed jutting rocks that could be used as handholds. In my dream, I was far more agile than in reality. When I got to the top, I stared down incredulously, because the inside walls were not bland concrete block buildings, but the ruined city I often dreamed of. All at once, I was a wolf again. I jumped down and padded along, sniffing at the greasy black cobbles, till I caught a horrible scent. Rather than being repelled, I lifted my muzzle and howled in triumph. Then I began to follow the fetid spore. It brought me to a tiny room in the side of a crumbled building, and here I found not Aya, but Serenity, huddled in rags and smeared with unspeakable filth. "Why are you following me?" she snarled. Only then did I realize that the terrible scent I had been following was coming from her. I woke deep in the night to find Mum in the bedroom. I wasn't frightened because she had a long habit of drifting through our rooms in the night, and more than once I had opened my eyes to find her looking down at me. Somehow, her presence almost seemed like an extension of my dream, because she was staring down at Serenity. When I woke in the morning, I couldn't decide if she really had been in the room, or if the whole thing had been a dream. I felt tired and headachy, but I resisted the temptation to beg a day home sick, because if Da called the school, they were bound to mention my absence on the Friday. Besides, I wanted to talk to Jilly. I dragged myself out of bed, groaning at the way my bones ached, and carefully faked a sick note from Da for the Friday. But Jilly didn't come for homeroom, or for English. I felt depressed, both by her absence and by the knowledge that I would be alone when I finally faced Harlan's wrath for standing him up on the weekend. But when he came in a few minutes after the bell, he didn't even glance at me. He went straight to the back of the class to sit with some of the tougher boys. I heard him laughing, and all at once, my idea that he was infected by a spiritual disease seemed fantastic and exaggerated. I went back to feeling like he must have done something bad that had affected his essence. It brought me again to the need to find out more about his past. But how? Mrs. Barker thwarted my reluctant plan to confront and apologize to Harlan after class by holding me back to tell me the results of my test had come through. I determined to talk to Harlan at recess or lunchtime, but I couldn't find him. It was almost as if he were now avoiding me. I went to the office to see if the school knew why Jilly was absent. The woman at the reception desk said no one had called in to say she was sick, and she suggested kindly that Jilly might have caught what I had on Friday. I felt myself flush guiltily. Afternoon recess came, and there was still no sign of her. I slipped out of school to call her from the phone box down the road. Fortunately for people like me, who didn't have a mobile, there were still a few of them around. You were not supposed to leave the grounds during school hours, but it seemed a small thing after I had already wagged a day to go to Shaletown. Standing in the phone booth, listening to the phone ring, I noticed the rain clouds clogging the sky were darker than ever. There was also a tense feel to the air that made me wonder if a storm was brewing. I was about to go back to school when it struck me that the dial tone had sounded odd. Besides, wouldn't there be an answering service switched on if there was no one at home? I dialed again, listened, then called the free service faults hotline. A man tested Jilly's number and agreed that there was something wrong with the line. He suggested I call back later to check the status. The end of recess bell had already rung by the time I got into the schoolyard, so I ran to get the books I needed for the next period. The locker passage was empty, but for Sylvia Yarrow, pushing books into her locker and swearing violently. "Are you okay?" I asked, picking up a notebook she had dropped and holding it out to her. She gave me an unseeing look as she reached out for it, and some impulse made me shift my hand and make physical contact. Immediately I felt hatred flow through me, thick and greasy, dark as a tide of oil. A nightmarish vision of hands pushing a white cat into a bath of water flashed into my mind. Unmistakably Sylvia's hands, because of all the rings she wore. I gave a cry of horror and jerked my hand away from her. Sylvia gaped at me. Then she turned and fled down the corridor, as if all the demons of hell were after her. She had left her locker door hanging open, and as I stood there, some books slid out and crashed to the floor. Shakily, I picked them up and stacked them inside, shutting the door to the locker with trembling hands. Then I got my own bag, knowing I couldn't just go and sit in class after what I had seen. I left the school, telling myself it couldn't be real memory I'd seen. Sylvia had been imagining killing the cat, but even to imagine such an awful, cruel thing was unthinkable. Alizon, I stared at Harrison in disbelief. What are you doing here? His brows lifted. I'm here to follow your sister. Oh, God, you shouldn't have worried about it. Sari would be the first to see I should do what I'd promised, Harrison said firmly. His eyes narrowed behind the spectacles. Are you all right, Alizon? You seem a wee bit strange. I tried to find something to say, but all I saw was the white cat, struggling and clawing the air, desperate and dying. All at once it seemed that the world I had lived in for 15 years was an illusion, cracking and breaking away to reveal a strange, dark world in which good-looking young men smelled of rot and girls murdered cats. It was as if the underbears of my childish nightmares had finally escaped. No, I heard myself saying in a thin voice, I'm not okay. Listen, Harrison, it's almost an hour before the school gets out, and there's a cafe just a few streets away. Can we go and get a drink? I really need to talk. Okay, he said. So what's up? He asked. He was sitting at a sticky plastic-covered table with two glasses of orange juice between us. The girl who had served us was cleaning the counter nearest us meticulously, but I doubted she would hear what we were saying because of the humming and wheezing of the drinks fridge. I took a deep breath. First, tell me about Sari. Is she okay? Harrison said soberly. She was pretty depressed to start with, but Dr. Austin is on holiday, and after I pointed out how long it had been since Sari's last episode, the doctor had taken his caseload, as willing to drop the dose. Did Sari say anything about me? He nodded, frowning slightly. She's still convinced you can smell the sickness in her, but Raoul managed to convince her that even if you could, it was only because the sickness must be in a stronger phase. He couldn't tell her that she'd just misunderstood you when she's half off her head with dope. I took a deep breath. At the hospital, you said you and the others had decided to believe Sari was sick, even though she had no way of proving it to you. Can you do the same for me? Believe something even though I've no proof of it? I'll try, he said calmly, and there was something in the combination of mildness and firmness that reassured me more than a truckload of words. I took a sip of the orange juice, which was too sweet, and blinked hard to stop a sudden hot gathering of tears behind my eyes. I wasn't sure why I had the impulse to cry. Maybe it was just shock at having arrived at the moment of telling. I collected myself and told him as concisely as I could about waking after the accident to find my senses had changed. Somewhat stiffly, I began to tell him about learning that I could smell what I thought of as people's essences, as well as their transient feelings, and how I had been forced to find ways to protect myself from their effect on me. Harrison did not interrupt to ask questions, but he looked intensely interested when I began to talk about the possibility of a spiritual sickness, a plague of wrongness, infecting people. When I told him about my encounter with Dr. Austin and how he had smelled, Harrison's brows climbed into his blonde fringe, and he suddenly said, "Are you saying Sari's right, and you can smell wrongness?" His accent was suddenly much thicker. "I don't know if it is wrongness that I can smell on Dr. Austin," I said slowly. "Sari didn't say so, did she?" "Sari cannot perceive wrongness in anyone but herself," Harrison said. And she never said anything about smelling wrongness until she was talking about you. She always talks about feeling it getting hungry or strong. But what does it mean that Dr. Austin wanted to drug you both? It can't be out to infect Sari, since she's already infected. Is she? I asked. Because that's another thing. She doesn't smell like Dr. Austin. It could be, but if she doesn't smell of... Are you saying it was just a coincidence that you started talking about the smell of wrongness to Sari? Harrison sounded incredulous. I shrugged. Is that any weirder than everything else we've been talking about? Gave a short laugh. Even so, I doubt it's a coincidence that you're both talking about a sickness that can't be seen or detected by normal means. There has to be a connection. I'll think on it. He glanced at his watch. Damn, I have to go, but we need to talk more about this. What happened just now in school anyway? You looked upset. I told him about Sylvia. You actually had a vision when you touched her? Harrison asked eagerly. I nodded. I can't figure if I was seeing a memory of some kind or a wish. I meant to tell what I had seen when Sari had grabbed me during her attack, but he was getting to his feet. I'd better head back to the school or I'll miss your sister. But you believe me, I said uncertainly. Of course I believe you, he said. I was so relieved that I felt myself blush. He went to pay, refusing my offer of money. When he came back, I got up, and we went out together. Did Sari ever say how she got infected? I mean, the actual process. Harrison shook his head. It's like when I told you and your dad at the hospital. It happened when she was too young to take it in clearly, but she always connects it with her mother's death. She would have been too young to resist anything then, so I guess it must take a while before the sickness becomes contagious. From what Sari said, it seems to get stronger in cycles, so maybe it's only contagious at certain times. Maybe that's when you can smell it. He looked at me, hesitating. How would you feel about telling Raoul and Jilly? I meant to tell all of you later this week at Raoul's, but speaking of Jilly, you don't happen to know why she didn't come to school today, do you? I tried to phone, but the operator said there's something wrong with the line. Harrison said something about line works. Then he told me I better not come back to school with him, in case Serenity saw us together. I agreed to go another way, and we said goodbye. But just as I was about to leave, Harrison stopped me and suggested we meet the next night. I can tell you what happens with your sister, and maybe we can talk more about your extended senses. That'd be great, I said, meaning it. I'll meet you by the phones around the corner from the library. 24. I cut through the back streets until I came out along the bus route. I could have walked home, but I felt really tired. It was the bus after the one most kids caught home anyway, and half empty. It wasn't until I got out that I realized Miranda had been on the bus. How come you're getting home late? I asked. Art, she said. I stifled a yawn as she launched into a description of a printmaking process she had been learning. So, Miranda suddenly turned and poked me in the arm. Pardon? I asked, realizing I had phased out completely. Miranda gave a huffing sigh of exasperation. Honestly, Alison, you're as bad as Serenity. That woke me up, because it made me realize that none of us talked to one another about how Serenity had changed. How come you're so down on poor Serenity? I asked, to provoke a reaction. I'm not down on poor Serenity, Miranda said indignantly. She's down on us, or hadn't you noticed? We're part of the great silent mass who fail to act decisively to stop injustice. Are you telling me you haven't had the "we are as guilty as the guilty if we don't act" lecture? Miranda said sardonically. Or what about the "cruel times need cruel measures"? Or maybe the most recent, the "sleepers awake" diatribe. That one's a doozy. I stared at her. Serenity doesn't lecture me. She doesn't speak to me. Miranda gave a short laugh. Yeah, well, maybe she thinks you're too far gone. Lucky you. So what does she expect us to do? What does she say? Who knows? Blow up the government, maybe. Idiot, I said, wondering why I had ever thought I would get any sense out of a person whose main motivation in life was to figure out what color to dye her hair next. He came round to the back door and I stifled a groan at the sound of Rona Wojciech's voice. Mum was in the kitchen, placidly feeding Luke a shiny blob of mushed-up banana in his high chair, her head swathed in clouds of blue and silver. Miranda dropped her bag and sat down to watch Rona with apparent devotion. I had to suppress a smile, because I knew that she was merely gathering material for an increasingly accurate and hilarious Rona mime she was developing. I slipped out the kitchen door, intending to go upstairs and change, but to my surprise, Dao was sitting on the bottom step, with a despondent air, his coffee ground scent overlaid with a confusion of other smells, new rope, tobacco, perfume, pine needles, detergent, but stronger than all the rest was the heavy, unpleasant reek of ammonia. Rona, I said sympathetically. She wants your mum to exhibit in a gallery that will cost an arm and a leg. I thought galleries just took a percentage of what sells. I sat down beside him. They do, but Rona wants a big opening and will need to pay for it. So don't do it, Mum won't care. She won't, but maybe Rona's right about the need to attract buyers and gallery owners. Zambia has always exhibited in obscure galleries in the past, but Hogan Gallery is visited by a lot of people who really care about art and have the money to indulge their passion for it. If they agree to stage the sort of show that would attract them... Something made me clamp on my senses hard enough to increase my ability to see the effect Da had on the air. Somehow, it didn't surprise me that the distortions were weaker today. "Are you okay, Da?" I said. "Tell me what is wrong," I thought at him. He turned his impossibly handsome face to me. "I guess it's that for once I have the potential to earn the money we need. Only..."
"Only what?" I pressed.
"I did that big charity function for Aaron Race this afternoon, and it turned out not to be a solo job after all. I ended up fronting another band, and afterwards Aaron asked if I would like to do a second gig with them. So what we're talking about now is a gig fronting another band."
"He lied about today's gig," I said.
"Ah, no," Dar said. "The lead singer was ill and Race asked me to fill in. It made no sense to switch halfway through to a solo act, so we did the whole show together. Afterwards, Aaron offered another gig with the band, because the singer's going to be out of commission for some time. It's a big gig with a good paycheck, and I feel..."
"Didn't you like the band?"
"It's not that," Dar said. He laughed. "I guess I just feel that by taking these gigs, I'm slipping further and further away from losing the rope. In the end, I told Aaron I'd give the job a miss, but he told me to think about it. Then I get home and find Rona talking about a big, expensive gallery opening."
He winced as the agent's laughter rang out.
"Oh, Da," I said. He smiled fondly at me. "I don't know why I'm so down, really. It's just one gig, after all."
Rona exploded out of the kitchen and into the hallway, trailing fringes and silk draperies and trilling a farewell to Jessie over her shoulder. He stopped and stared to see Da and me sitting at the bottom of the stairs, but Mum, coming along behind her, only smiled at us both and ushered Rona the rest of the way out. I went up and lay on my bed, wondering if Aaron Race was really out to separate Da from losing the rope. Did he truly believe Da would be a better property if he was a soloist or played with some other band? I fell asleep and dreamed one of those chaotic and troubling dreams that metamorphose slowly but spectacularly into a nightmare. I was at one of Losing the Rope's gigs, only the band seemed to be missing half their instruments. Mel went to find them, and when he didn't come back, Neil and Da sent me to get them. I ended up blundering into some sort of nightclub peopled horribly by animated corpses. Finally, one of them noticed me and leered, baring his sharpened teeth. It was Aaron Race.
"I see you," he hissed, and suddenly the air was full of tiny creatures, biting and tearing at me. I staggered back in horror, but he grabbed me and shook me and shook me.
"Alison, come on, dinner's ready."
It was Jessie shaking me hard. I sat up groggily, heavy-eyed and jittery.
"What time is it?"
"Almost dinner time," he called over his shoulder. "Come and set the table."
Over dinner, I studied Serenity, looking for clues that she might know she'd been followed, but she was exactly the same as usual, pale, silent, and withdrawn, pushing food around her plate. After dinner, she went straight up to bed. I didn't want to go up with her, so I hung around downstairs, listening to Da and Jesse jam. Then I had a shower. As I was coming out of the bathroom, Jesse told me Jilly had phoned earlier in the evening. I meant to tell you right away when you got home, but Rona came and you know how she obliterates consciousness. I laughed, relieved. Jilly must have called to say why she'd missed school. It's too late to call her back now. I'll ring tomorrow. I swear you two are sick-making, Miranda commented, heading for the bathroom. What do you mean? I asked, puzzled. This best friends thing with you and Jilly Roundtree, I mean, you're practically a hermit, and all of a sudden you have this bosom buddy, and everyone's talking about how close you two are. What do you mean, everyone? Oh, don't worry. Everyone thinks it's sweet that you two are so inseparable that you even do the bin run together. Miranda went into the bathroom and shut the door. I woke to the déjà vu experience of Jesse shaking me again, but it felt too early and too dark. Phone, Jesse said softly. It's your friend Harrison. He says it's urgent. I dragged on a dressing gown and slippers and hurried downstairs, my heart yammering. Harrison, what's wrong? Jilly just called. She said she phoned there yesterday, but you didn't get back to her. It was too late to call by the time Jesse gave me the message, I said. But what is it? Is Jilly in some kind of trouble? She's fine, but her grandmother's house burned down on Sunday night. I gasped. It's okay. No one got hurt. Luckily, her grandmother was at the opera, and Jilly was with me and Raoul visiting Sari. She only found out after she left us and went home in a taxi. She didn't call straight away because it was totally chaotic. Her grandmother was in shock, and there were police asking questions, and they had to get some clothes and find somewhere to stay. Oh, my God! I tried to call Sunday night, and then again yesterday. Remember I told you? There was this weird tone. I even reported it. My voice trailed off, and I had the bizarre image of a phone ringing and at the same time going up in flames. Harrison said, whoever did it threw litres of kero around to make sure the fire was hot. Someone did it on purpose, I asked, horrified. What about the housekeeper and the driver? They've a house separate from the main residence, but they were out as well. The movies, the police think that's why it happened. Unfortunately, it also means that no one swore anything. But why would anyone do such a thing? It could have been a robbery, and someone wanted to make sure it'd be hard for anyone to figure out what had been stolen. Or vandalism, a sort of payback for the rich. There's a lot of that happening, apparently. Anyway, I'm sorry I called you so early, but I didn't know what time you left for school, and I thought you'd want to know. Jilly won't be at school again today, of course. Where are Jilly and her grandmother now? I asked, feeling dazed and appalled. In a hotel. Would you like to go and see her tonight? We could meet as planned at the library, then go to her hotel afterwards. I think she'd be glad if you'd come. Of course. I'll ask Dad to pick me up from the hotel. Harrison gave me the address, then rang off. Only after I put down the receiver did I realize that he had not mentioned Serenity. What's up? Jesse asked, passing me a mug of tea he'd made. Dar came in, carrying Luke, halfway through me telling Jesse. That nice, gentle old lady, he said, when I had finished. But where are they staying? I explained and told him about my arrangement to go to Hotel Marceau after school with Harrison. Okay, Dar said. Alison, let Mrs. Roundtree know if there's anything she needs, just a call. Even in the midst of my shock, I was touched by the thought of Dar offering to help someone as rich as Mrs. Roundtree. On the other hand, perhaps there was a kind of help someone like Da could give that no one else could. I was thinking of Portia Sting and the way Da had radiated sparks and bent the air the night of the Urban Dingo gig. Perhaps his bending of the air was some sort of positive or healing force that helped anyone within range. I was thinking about Jilly and the fire when I got off the bus and saw Harlan standing a little way along the fence from the school gates, with the same older guise I had seen him with the day I'd fled from him. I hadn't even mentioned Harlan to Harrison. This was such a strange omission that it made me wonder if my own senses had somehow subconsciously stopped me. I went straight over to Harlan, refusing to think about anything but the apology I must make. When he saw it was me, his eyes went cold and flat, but his mouth kept right on smiling, like it had its own life. The smell of rot coming from him was overpowering, and suddenly it didn't seem the least bit exaggerated to think he might carry a contagious sickness of the spirit. "Harlan, I'm really sorry I didn't come to Eastland on Saturday. I didn't get a chance to tell you yesterday, but I was on my way to meet you when this girl I know had a fit. I would have called from the hospital, but I didn't have your number." I said this, looking right into his eyes, all the time screaming so hard it was making my head ache. "A sick friend," one of his companions said with sneering disbelief. I glared at him with genuine indignation. "I wouldn't make up a thing like that." I looked back at Harlan. "My friend really did have a fit, and you can ask Jilly because she knows her too. Why would I lie, anyway?" There was a strangely long pause, and then the other guy who hadn't spoken said mockingly to Harlan, "Seems like she might be telling the truth. Too bad, eh?" Harlan snapped at him to shut up, and then he stepped closer to me. "I was pretty mad," he said. "I thought you'd stood me up for Jilly because I saw her in town about an hour after we were supposed to meet, and she told me she was going to see you later in the day." "I would never deliberately stand someone up," I said. "An honourable woman," said the guy who had spoken, leering at me. I was glad, because looking at him let me turn away from Harlan. For a moment, instead of his sick, rotting stench, I was enveloped in the boiled cabbage and dirty tracksuit odour that was a smell of the other guy's essence. "Are you a friend of Harlan's?" I asked, because, unpleasant as his smell was, it was infinitely better than Harlan's. "I'm Quick," he said. "This here is Breeze. We used to go to school with Harlan until it shut up shop." He gave a delighted chuckle. "Shut up," Harlan said again, forcing my eyes back to him. "So, Alizon, if you didn't really mean to stand me up, how about meeting me tonight?"
"Oh, I can't," I said. "Haven't you heard? Jilly's house was burned down on Sunday. I'm supposed to go and see her and her grandmother tonight."
For a second, Harlan's face was so still, it was like someone had used a pause button on him. Then he said,
"Jilly's house burned down. Incredible. Who do the police think did it?"
The bell started ringing before I could answer.
"Time to rock and roll," Quick said, and he slouched off down the street with the silent Breeze in tow.
"Who were those two?" demanded the duty teacher as Harlan and I came through the gate.
"I've seen them hanging round here. I'm not keen on it." "They were after directions," Harlan lied coolly, shooting me a look of smiling complicity.
I forced myself to smile back, glad that the teacher was coming along right behind us. 25. Never had school seemed less relevant than it did the rest of that day. My thoughts kept jumping from Jilly and her grandmother, losing everything in the fire, to Serenity, eaten up by grief and rage, to Aaron Race, trying to separate Dar from losing the rope, and then to poor Sari at the mercy of a doctor who smelled of something old and rotten. And of course, I thought of Harlan. It felt as if a shadow was creeping through the world, darkening all the separate threads of my life. I spent the morning avoiding places where Harlan might look for me, not wanting him to ask me out again, not wanting to have to make another excuse. I clung to the hope that once Harrison and the others knew about him, they would be able to think of a way to thwart his interest in me without antagonizing him. The truth was that my mind had sort of frozen where Harlan was concerned. At lunchtime, I made for the library, intending to use their terminals to check out Aaron Race. But Harlan was there before me, leaning over the checkout desk and smiling at the sixth form monitor behind it. I backed away hastily and headed for the computer room, reasoning that Harlan would be unlikely to find me there if he'd staked out the library. As I waited for someone to leave, I found myself thinking about the conversation by the fence with Harlan and the other two guys. It had been niggling at me on and off all morning, and suddenly I realized why. One of the creepy guys with him had mentioned the school they had all gone to, shutting up shop. That had been why I couldn't find a trace of him at Shaletown College. There had been another school. Finally, someone left. I gathered my wits and sat down. I typed Aaron Race's name into the search engine, then got out the business card I had filched from Dar's pocket that morning. Race, Inc., was printed on the heavy, silky card in long, elegant gold lettering. Under it was the word Consultants in smaller but equally elegant script. Then, In the bottom left-hand corner was an address, a fax number, and a website. My pulse quickened at the latter, but having set a search in motion, I decided to wait and see what it netted before trying the website. The only other thing on the card was a logo which had been so distorted that it was impossible to make out what it had been to begin with. What struck me was how little information the card offered, unless you took the luxurious quality of its production as its message. The computer beeped, and I looked up to find a surprisingly long list. Moving the cursor down over the entries, I discovered that most of them were just mentions in society papers or gossip magazines. I typed in the website address and pressed go. The loading bar filled slowly, then an image flickered into the middle of the screen. It was the logo on the business card. There were no words on the page, so I shifted the cursor to the logo and tapped twice. The logo flickered like flame, then vanished, leaving a white coil of smoke which wound itself into a single line of text. Light the flame, and all shall be consumed by your radiance. It sounded vaguely religious to me, or maybe it came from something like Dante's Inferno or William Blake. I was still staring at the words in bafflement when they quivered and vanished. What came up next was possibly the plainest home page I'd ever seen. It was just the name, Race, Inc., in thin black letters with the word Consultants under it, above an old-fashioned-looking photograph of a two-story mansion. Castle Dean Estate was written on a plate by the door, and under it was a Remington address. There was nothing to say what purpose the house served, but I gathered it must be Race's headquarters, because under the address was a paragraph explaining that Race Incorporated had been set up in 1968, although there was no information about what Race Inc. actually did. I tapped on the paragraph, but nothing happened. I tried tapping on the name of the company, and then on the word consultants. Nothing. I scrolled back up to the top of the page and examined it more closely, finding only one thing I had not noted the first time, a small slot with numbers in it that looked like a register of hits for the website, but the number was so high it didn't seem possible. Maybe it was a website registration figure. I studied the paragraph again and wondered if Race Inc. was some sort of charity organization. After all, most of the gigs he had given Da were to do with charities, and it might explain the religious-sounding quote. But where were the photographs of thin, big-eyed children, or desert-like fields or rivers full of floating filth, or the appeals to conscience and humanity by well-known actors or sports figures? Where were the lists of countries that had received aid from Race Inc., or an outline of current projects that might entice someone to donate money? Where, in fact, was the plea for a donation? Perhaps the entrepreneur was a consultant to people who wanted to set up charities. I knew that businesses sometimes set them up, but I couldn't think of any way to check my theory, especially when I only had 5 more minutes before the bell rang. I looked back to the screen and noticed that the panel with the name of the house on it, in the photograph, looked as if it were computer-generated. I shifted the cursor to it and tapped. The photo began to fragment and blow away like leaves in a high wind, and then I was looking at 4 boxes, within which were 4 more religious-sounding lines of text. The first said, "Who would teach the world? Enter here." The second said, "Who would change the world? Inquire within." The third read, "Who would save the world? Come hither." And the last, "Who would despair of the world? Come forth." I shifted the cursor to the first square and tapped. Nothing happened, nor did any of the other boxes yield more than their text. I scrolled in all directions, but there was nothing hidden. Then, all at once, the screen image began to disintegrate. The mouse wouldn't respond, and a moment later, to my mortified horror, a bondage site came up, complete with a picture of a naked woman tied up and grimacing in pain. I was astonished, because the computer nanny the school used ought to have immediately blocked the download. I was still trying to get rid of the image when the bell rang. There was nothing for it but to switch off the whole computer, to disrupt the connection, and get rid of the porn site. I made my way to the art room, thinking that Aaron Race's website was like a game, and a virtual idiot like me was not going to crack it without help.
Miranda might manage, but she could never have kept her mouth shut about the fact that I was looking into Race ink. I was soon in the art room up to my neck in paints and linseed oil, making my usual inept mess. Whatever else had changed, I had not developed artistic abilities, but at least the class took my mind off everything else. Because of the need to clean up after, the class always ran over time, and for once I was glad, because it meant I would not have to worry about Harlan waiting around for me. But it did mean that I had to run like hell to make the city-bound bus that would bring me to the library in time to meet Harrison. When the bus pulled up at the library, however, Harrison jumped on before I could get off. "This bus stops close to the hotel, so I thought we might as well go straight there," he said when he was seated beside me. "We'll be early, but there's a park right beside it where we can go for a walk." I asked if he had seen Sari again, and his face lit up. "Raoul and I went in to visit her last night. She's fine. In fact, she's more than fine, because not only has the filling doctor stopped the dose of drugs, he's agreed to sign her release to allow her to enter a convalescent home in Remington, which means she's permanently out of Dr. Austin's clutches." His mention of Remington gave me a little start, because that was where Castledean Estate was. Harrison went on, saying he'd been thinking that we ought to check up on Dr. Austin and find out exactly when he'd started treating Sari. I opened my mouth to tell Harrison about Harlan, and this time I definitely felt a resistance to speak. But maybe it was just that we were among other people who might overhear. I decided to wait until we were in the park to try again. To my relief, Harrison switched back to talking about the convalescent home, telling me it was called Bellevue and describing its facilities. It sounded so luxurious that I worried how Sari could afford it. Harrison said lightly that Raoul would take care of it. We fell silent then, because the bus was getting really crowded. But when we were in the park, Harrison told me Jilly had said her grandmother seemed to be getting more devastated by the fire as time passed. "It's the photographs and mementos she minds most. Jilly said she seemed really lost and apathetic, as if nothing matters anymore." "How awful for her," I murmured, wondering if the person who lit the fire had any idea or even cared about the harm they had done. "I suppose Jilly's mother will come back now." "She won't know what happened unless she logs on to a local news link or gets a local paper. From what Jilly says, she doesn't make contact very often." "Poor Jilly," I said, trying to imagine how I would feel if my parents had gone abroad for months on end without calling. We came to a bench, and Harrison suggested we sit for a bit. "I want to tell you what happened with your sister last night." My heartbeat quickened, because his manner seemed to suggest that he had discovered something. "I spotted her easily as she came out the gate, because she changed out of her school uniform into black clothes," Harrison said. "She went straight to the city bus stop and caught the bus to the library." "So she does go there," I said. Harrison ignored my interruption. "She went inside, sat down, and got out some school books. Then a whole bunch of little kids poured in for some sort of story-reading session. I was distracted for a second, and when I looked back to where your sister had been sitting, I got the shock of my life, because she'd gone." I stared at him. "What do you mean, gone?" "Gone. Her bag, her books. I raced outside thinking she must have spotted me, but she was nowhere to be seen. I knew she couldn't have caught a bus, because there were lines of people waiting at the stops on both sides of the street, and she would have had to run like hell to get around the corner before I was out in the street. So I calmed down. I figured she must have just gone to the toilet, but when I went back inside the hall, I saw her going into one of those side meeting rooms with a bunch of other people." She was going to a meeting? I could hardly believe it. I waited until the door shut. Then I went to the desk and asked who was meeting. The guy said it was a poetry group called the Morality Complex that meets every week on Monday nights. They were regular booking. "A poetry group," I said, explosively, relieved and also exasperated. Trust Serenity to make a poetry reading so secretive. I felt like strangling her. Harrison went on. "I asked if anyone could join, and he said the dinner seemed to want any new members, even though there were only about 10 regulars. There'd been more when they started meeting last year, but there'd been a big dropout rate. I went back to the meeting room. I was going to barge in and pretend I got the wrong door, but it wouldn't budge. There are no locks, so someone had to be holding it closed from the inside. I knocked, and finally this tall, tough-looking guy came out and asked what I wanted. I told him I wanted to join. He said they were not looking for new members right now. I asked when they would be, and he said it wasn't possible for anyone to join who'd not shown proper commitment. Commitment to what? I asked. To idealism, he said. I asked how you showed commitment to idealism, and he said that was the challenge. Then he told me to push off. I didn't press it, because for all he was talking about idealism, he actually looked like he wanted to ram his fist down my throat. A poetry club, I said, thinking it would be just like Serenity to find some dysfunctional group of poets to join. A pretty weird poetry group, Harrison said, but I hardly heard him. I guess she was in the library that day, like she said. I didn't look in the back rooms. I felt stupid for having sent him on a wild goose chase and said so. He smiled. I didn't mind it. The truth is, I felt like James Bond, only shorter. I laughed, lightened by his self-deprecating humour, but also by the fact that my dark imaginings about Serenity seemed to be unfounded. Harrison glanced at his watch and said we should go in. I had to lean into the wind as we came back through the park, because it had started to blow hard. Leaves were whipping around us and flying up into the air from the ground, as if they wanted to turn back time. Hotel Marceau was a big fancy building facing the park all along one side, and the doorman, it was that kind of hotel, gave off a disparaging smell of Drano when he opened the door for me, though his face was smoothly polite. I felt self-conscious in my shabby, too-big, too-long uniform and scuffed school shoes, and realised I ought to have had the sense to bring clothes to change into. Harrison's dark corduroy trousers and the grey wool jumper and jacket were expensive and tasteful, and as he approached the gleaming desk, I saw that he was far more at ease in the surroundings than I was. The sleek blonde receptionist told us we were to wait in the restaurant. I thought her eyes flickered as they passed from Harrison to me, but when I extended my senses, she only smelled of flowers and toasted cheese, which was a lesson to me not to be so paranoid. Nevertheless, when I saw how fancy the restaurant was, I panicked, because Da had given me $20, and I had the feeling that a glass of water might cost more than that here. A waiter appeared, so smooth he might have been oiled, checked a list, and said, "We must be Miss Jilly Roundtree's guests." I felt like we'd stepped into a novel set in a previous century, and tried to control a mixture of extreme unease and hysterical amusement as we followed him to a table by the window. He took up the white table napkin, unfolded it with a practiced snap, and laid it on my lap like a conjurer. I had to bite my lip to stop from laughing. When the waiter left, after performing the same service for Harrison, he leaned close and said in a pompous voice, "Is everything in order, Miss Allison?" That finished me. I burst out laughing, and even though I clapped my hands over my mouth at once, the sound seemed to reverberate around the near-empty restaurant, making irises tremble in their vases. Harrison said seriously, "Laughter is forbidden in places like this. You're permitted to smile discreetly, so long as you didn't show any teeth." As it always did, whenever he was messing around, his accent had grown stronger, and I realized how much I liked it. The waiter returned and asked if we would like to have an appetizer, and my amusement fell into the hole that opened up in my stomach. "I didn't realize we'd be eating," I stammered. I could feel my face burn and thought how stupid it was to be embarrassed about not having much money. Before he could respond, Jilly appeared, and I felt immediately guilty that I had not been thinking about her and her house burning down. But she only threw her arms around me and kissed me on the cheek. I stiffened, but fortunately all she was feeling was a rush of gladness at seeing me, and like Da, thinking about me, it didn't hurt a bit. I hugged her back, relishing the clean sea scent of her. Then she let me go and hugged Harrison too. To my relief, the waiter had gone away again. "I'm so glad to see you both," Jilly said, flopping down between us. "Jilly, I'm sorry about your gran's house," I said. She sighed. "I know, but the house isn't so bad. It's all gran's things that were burned. She just can't understand why someone would want to do such a thing.
She seemed so old and frail all of a sudden. I always felt she was this tough old woman that I didn't much like, and who didn't much like me. But ever since that night you came over, Alizon, it's like we've seen each other differently. I guess we stopped looking at one another through the anger we felt about Mum. I never realized that Gran felt abandoned by her because of her being my dad's mother. He doesn't even bother to call her, you know, her own son. I always thought he did, and she just didn't tell me. All those stupid things I used to think about her being this rich old aristocrat. I really admire her. She says she doesn't know how she'd have coped if it wasn't for me. She really means it, too. The waiter came back, and when he asked if anyone was ready to order, Harrison announced rather brusquely that he didn't have any money with him. Julie looked at him in surprise. Then she shrugged and said, "It doesn't matter anyway, because Gran's insisting dinner's her treat. You have to accept or she'll be offended." I felt Harrison look at me. Then he said, "Okay, why not?" I nodded, relieved it had been decided without me having to admit my own poverty. The waiter had stood like a statue throughout this, but he came to life as we ordered. "What about Raoul?" Harrison asked. "He just rang to say he'll come for dessert and coffee. He's trying to finish a job," Julie explained. The meal came quickly, and as if by consent, we didn't talk about anything serious while we ate. I was surprised how hungry I felt, and the food was really good. Once the waiter had cleared the dishes away, Julie told him with a poise I envied that we would wait for coffee and dessert because we were expecting another friend. "What will your gran do now?" Harrison asked. She shrugged. "We'll find another house. We're lucky that the insurance will pay. It must be dreadful if a house is burned down and there's no money for another one. But the idea of getting all the furniture and stuff for it..." She sighed. "It won't be so bad for me, but poor Gran. She put that house together over her whole life with Grandad. All the furniture and paintings and rugs she bought with him, or with her sister who died, or with friends who are dead or far away. Or she bought them on her travels. Each bit was like a piece of her history. It's not like a house burned down for her. It's like someone burned up a whole lot of her past." Harrison had started to tell her of an organization he read about that decorated houses for families relocating from another country when Raoul appeared, wheeling up the ramp leading from the foyer to the restaurant. I thought, as he rolled across the room towards us, dark and handsome in a suit and yellow shirt, that he managed to make a wheelchair look sophisticated. Julie's eyes lit up when she saw him, and as he smiled at her, the air between them bent, first one way and then the other. "So that's what love looks like," I thought. My neck prickled, and I turned to see Harrison watching me. I flushed, realizing he knew that I was eavesdropping with my extended abilities. Julie began talking about Harrison's idea of how to set up a new house for her grandmother, and Raoul said it might also be possible to shop online in some of the places where Mrs. Rowntree had once travelled, so that she would literally be able to revisit her past. "I could show her how to log in here at the hotel," he said. "A cyber trip down memory lane with real mementos," Julie murmured, looking excited. "I think Gran might like that." Their talk about the internet reminded me of my own abortive attempt to learn about Aaron Race. When there was a lull in the conversation, I asked Raoul if he had ever heard of a company called Race Inc. He hadn't, but when I explained about its strange website, he looked intrigued and offered to try to get deeper into it, just as I had hoped. I gave him Aaron Race's card and explained my misgivings about Dar and the entrepreneur. Even to me they sounded vague. And finally, I said weakly, "I'd just like to know what sort of man he is and what he does." "I'll look into it," Raoul promised. "Maybe I'll have something for you when you come to my place on the weekend. I hope you'll be able to come, Alizon," he said. Then he glanced at Julie. "Of course we can postpone the game test if you don't want to leave your grandmother alone." "I'll see how she is," Julie said. "Harrison told me you've managed to get the fill-in doctor to agree to let Sari go to a private convalescent home." Raoul smiled. "I spoke to the doctor before I came here, and Sari is due to be shifted to Bellevue Convalescent Home at the end of the week. The papers have been signed, which means she's out of Dr. Austin's clutches." This was the same phrase Harrison had used, and when I glanced at him, I was startled to find him watching me, his eyes expectant. "What's with you two?" Jilly asked, curiously. I was suddenly filled with doubt. Look, I want to tell you something, but I don't know if